We really didn't set out to have a Valentine's show this week, I swear. There's only one segment that's explicitly about romance and relationships. And yet, when I looked at everything all together, I realized that we actually have a lot of stories about love. Broadly defined love, we are including budget stories in this. You gotta pay for what you love. But love nonetheless. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. So, yes, you're going to hear about love and technology, and that goes way beyond dating apps, but also about maternal love in Brazil in the age of the Zika virus, and nostalgic love for the TV shows of the 1990s. Come tell us if you love our stories, or hate my puns, on Marketplace.org, Marketplace's Facebook page, or on Twitter, we're at Marketplace WKND. I mentioned budgets, and we're going to start the show by talking about them. Yes, the president proposed his 2017 budget this week. No, it's not going anywhere the way it is. Presidential budgets are wish lists to begin with, and Obama is both a lame duck and facing a Congress that disagrees with him. But every time any president introduces a budget, I think about this scene from the movie Dave, where Kevin Kline, who runs a temp agency and looks like and through complex factors is pretending to be the president, tries to cut the budget with help from his accountant best friend, played by Charles Grodin.
You gotta cut the budget.
Yeah.
About $650 million.
I'll tell you, Dave, I've been over this stuff a bunch of times. It just doesn't add up. Who does these books? I mean, if I ran my business this way, I'd be out of business.
Right. So, national books are not really like a business or a family. The law mandates certain things the country must spend on, for example. But that got us wondering about what your budget priorities are and how you plan to get there. Mark Kenny got in touch from Cincinnati about his priorities.
My biggest budget priority, I just bought a house in November.
Oh.
So the mortgage is a good chunk of the budget. And it's an older house, 1910s. So fixing the box gutters, doing a couple updates, those are definitely big budget priorities for me. Another good chunk gets eaten up by student loan payments. My wife has student loans outstanding, so those take up a decent chunk of our budget. Other than that, my wife's looking to go to Europe this summer, so we're saving up for that. And so between the mortgage, the student loans, and saving up for travel, that pretty much eats it all up. So.
Are you the kind of couple who sits down and, like, makes a very precise allocation of what you want to have happen?
I am responsible for doing the spreadsheets. I use Mint to track spending, and then we'll come up with a monthly budget that I track. So I'd say we are not the norm in that sense.
Yeah, you're an urban planner, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So are you like a very plannery type person in all aspects of your life?
Less so than I think I should be. But when it comes to finances, I'm definitely a planner type. So,
Laura Duman of Edmond, Oklahoma, is also a planner type. She came to us through Facebook and walked me through her budget.
First of all, it's getting the student loans and the mortgage paid every month. And then it's food and trying to budget for the necessary upkeep on the house. And then after all of the necessities are paid, then we have our retirement accounts and our children's college education funds. And we have our own savings accounts in there, too.
The way you listed those things and the pause before you got to retirement and the kids' education, it sounds like this is not easy.
It is not, no. We are a one-income family right now, and that provides some challenges, for sure. There are definitely some stresses. We've had to give up on a lot of the fun things, like going out ever or going on vacations. And so it's just kind of what it is, but sometimes it's sad to not be able to go on some of these trips or to just eat out whenever we want to or to go see a movie.
I know that you're the breadwinner and your husband's in school.
Yeah.
Do you guys sit down and sort of, you know, work this stuff out on a computer, on a piece of paper, and you know, make a formal budget?
Yes. I have an Excel spreadsheet that I've been running for myself for about 20 years now to keep the budget.
Wow.
Yeah.
You started doing that as a 19-year-old? Oh, my God.
Yes, I did. I wanted to know where my money was going. And so I put together a budget, and it lists out every single bill and all of our savings accounts. And so, yes, I am able to see usually down to about the penny where our money has gone each month.
You know, we did this segment and you responded to this question about the president's budget. And a government budget and household budgets are totally different things. But when you think about what a presidential budget is, it's kind of a wish list. So if you had the chance, I guess, to make a wish list, what would be on that?
It would definitely include some more spending money to be able to fix up the house. It would include money to be able to go on one vacation a year. And, you know, it doesn't have to be a month-long trip around Europe. It could just be going to the beach for a week. It would include enough money so that we don't have to worry at the end of the month if there's going to be enough money for food. Or enough money so that when somebody needs new shoes, we don't have to look another month out and save up for it. So it would include just, I guess, cushion money.
Thanks to everyone who called and wrote in. And since it's both Valentine's and President's Day weekend, sales are everywhere. Mattresses, cars, jewelry, you know, everyone wants you to buy right now. And that got us thinking. We want to know, what's the impulse buy you've made that you will always remember, possibly regret? Go to Marketplace.org, Marketplace's Facebook page, or call us 1-800-648-5114. By now, you probably know the terms long and short. Long for betting on something, like a stock. Short for betting against it. We do that here with news stories, topics and trends that our guests are positive and negative about. This week, to play the long and short game, we've got Jillian White, Senior Associate Editor at The Atlantic, and Marketplace's own Mark Arison. Welcome back, guys.
Thanks.
Hey, guys.
All right. Mark, I'm going to let you kick this off. Give me your long.
Okay, I'm actually long road trips, because we've been having this discussion like there's cheap gas, but why aren't people spending a little bit more? It seems like they're more likely putting the money that they're saving on gas into the bank. So my thinking is that perhaps if gas stays cheap, as it seems like it will for some months, and people are still a little concerned, whatever it is that's making them save instead of spend, they could see the road trip as kind of a, you know, uncertain economy-friendly type of vacation.
I like that. I mean, I really hope my father's not listening to this, because he used to make us drive from Washington, D.C. to the Upper Peninsula in Michigan.
Oh, no.
It's like a 15-hour trip, and do it in one thing. It was awful.
We used to do St. Louis to New Jersey and just get it done.
Yeah, this is just bringing back very scary memories for me. All right, Jillian, roll out your long for me.
All right, so my long is diversity in the workplace, but showing it and backing it up.
I was going to say, with diversity in the workplace, this is a long time long for so many companies, but how do you back it up?
So recently, Slack, the messaging software that has taken over so many of our offices, they won a TechCrunch award for fastest rising startup. And their CEO was not there. And in his stead, he sent up 4 black female engineers. And when I heard that, I was like, I don't think I've ever seen 4 black female engineers anywhere, let alone at some tech awards. And the premise of their speech was basically, hey, this is also what an engineer can look like. And then not only did they do that, but then the company released their actual stats on diversity for women and minorities. And it was kind of like, we didn't just do this as a gesture. It's something that we're really trying, and we're going to let you show where we're making progress and where we're not. And I think that's the really important piece right now.
All right. Mark, hit me with your short.
I am short Marshmallow Peeps, which began as a wonderful confection for Easter. Easter, yellow chicks in and around the Easter season. But they've become something that has to be in every single holiday. And so they have Valentine's Day Peeps, if you can Google these.
I am Googling Valentine's Day.
Prepare your eyes for a little horror, because they have this kind of crimson dipped kind of thing about them, like they've just been at some kind of crime scene investigation or something. But my issue is that, you know, they're basically diluting the brand.
But don't they need to make some money? And there are a lot of holidays out there. Seems like a great way to do
it.
There are other things one can do, but like the Peep has a special place. And if you dilute that, then the novelty of the Peep around the Easter season is lost. And I feel that they're hurting an asset.
I want to be short on Peeps in general. I never understood the point. Like, why are we drawing on a marshmallow and making it look like a bunny? I don't get it. Let's just have a marshmallow. They're delicious.
So the color and the characterization is the issue? You just want just a proper minimalist cylinder?
Yeah, absolutely.
Am I getting that right,
yeah.
Jillian?
And I want it to continue being versatile, and that way we wouldn't have this issue with assigning it a holiday. I want to be able to have a marshmallow whenever I want it. I just don't need it to look like a bunny.
A marshmallow for all seasons.
Exactly.
All right. Jillian, what's your short?
This may come from a place of personal bitterness, but these online ticket sales and all the issues with scalpers and vendors and the 37 pre-sales that happen before a regular sale— it just seems like the internet was supposed to make things easier, and things are now so complex and awful. And I don't know who actually has time to sit around in front of five screens refreshing everything, trying to get tickets for one artist and then wind up paying $700 a head. But I don't.
Right. I mean, the prices.
It's absurd.
The tickets for Beyonce's Formation tour I saw online today, you know, and basic seat, we're talking $300.
Yeah, but also I get it. I, too, want to see Beyonce.
Yeah, I mean, I don't quite know how one solves this. I get the short, but I don't then know, you know.
I mean, I am close to saying that I would rather just go stand in a line and wait for some tickets. At least I know where I am. I know who I'm buying from. I know that when I get there, no one will tell me it's already been scanned, which is the worst thing on earth. And I've seen it happen to folks. I mean, it doesn't seem like a really viable option, but it almost seems like, was that really all that much worse than what's happening now? I don't know.
Jillian White from The Atlantic, Mark Garrison from Marketplace, thank you both very much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
The stories on our shows are often dominated by numbers, which is kind of the nature of money. And here at Marketplace, our By the Numbers blog tracks them and posts them every day on marketplace.org. Here are producers Tony Wagner and Raghu Manavalan with some of this week's news by the numbers. Tony.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number?
5.2 million.
Is how many dollars Senator Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign raised from the time polls closed Tuesday in New Hampshire to the next morning?
He beat Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton in the primary, which led to a flood of donations averaging $34 apiece.
It's been a big week for Sanders, and the footage of him shooting hoops on Fox News was priceless.
98.
Time Warner Cable says they were on time for service appointments at a rate of 98% the past three quarters.
Yeah, we know that the big cable companies still have pretty terrible reputations, but they're showing some signs of improvement.
For Time Warner's part, they've used tech upgrades to shorten that dreaded arrival window from 4 to 8 hours to just one.
200,000.
That's the dollar value of the gift bag nominees we'll pick up at the Oscars later this month.
It includes cosmetics, fancy candy, free car rentals, a vaporizer, and even a trip to Israel.
The bags are filled and distributed by a third party firm, not the Academy, and they're basically just giant commercials.
Commercials you have to report on your taxes, that is.
Exactly this time last year, I was in Brazil, working on a story about what it's like to be in the middle class there. And as part of that story, we met Eleonora de Mello and her family.
Pode ficar à vontade, a gente tá fazendo janta.
Make yourself at home, we are cooking dinner.
Quer uma água, um suco, uma coca?
Water, juice, coke.
My producers and I had dinner with them at their house outside Sao Paulo. Eleonora works in a boutique in a high-end mall, and she's saving up to open her own beauty salon. She's now 27, and she's 4.5 months pregnant. She and her husband have been trying for this baby for a while, and getting pregnant wasn't easy. And now, in the middle of an already tough time in Brazil, the country's in recession, Eleonora is terrified of the Zika virus. Zika's been linked to brain damage and microcephaly in fetuses. We called her up to talk about how she's doing. You'll hear her talk about Pernambuco. That's the state in Brazil where Zika has been most prevalent. I spoke to Eleonora through a translator. What is it like? Are you scared?
Yes, I'm really scared. Also because the media news that we get show that things are not too clear. So you get scared by that.
I've been to your house and, you know, there's some water nearby and you go up the stairs. Have you had to make changes to kind of your living space to protect from mosquitoes?
We have been really careful about things with plants and etc. around the house. And we had a little problem with a neighbor because her water reservoir had a Aedes aegypti focus. So we told them that and they did nothing about it. So we have to go to the police to make a claim. Because sometimes people, they take care for their part, but they don't worry about the others. So we have to be very careful.
What are they telling you in the news or what are you hearing from the government about how to protect yourself?
The only thing they tell us to do is to use a lot of repellent for mosquitoes and to take care of the Aedes aegypti focus. So the places where there's water that can attract the mosquitoes, that's the only thing they tell you to do.
What does your doctor say?
Well, that Zika causes microcephalia, but it's really confusing, different information coming from different places. It's all really shady. And the mothers that were infected with the virus and were pregnant in Pernambuco are now going to abort. They are being allowed to abort their kids. So this is a lot of pain for the mothers and also for the families.
This is a difficult question, but if you knew that your child had microcephaly, would you abort?
No.
What would you like to see the government do in Brazil?
So what we wanted is for them to take a stand and make it clear for us what is the cause of microcephalia and if Zika is related to it. Because the problem is that nothing is clear for us right now. So the news everywhere just tells us to prevent, and that's what we've been doing. But we're frightened. So we just wanted the government to really tell us what is the cause of microcephalia and what exactly we can do. Because this way it's really confusing.
Thank you, Eleonora. Muito obrigado. Obrigada.
Thank you very much.
It's pretty common in an election season to hear a lot about polls, whether it's Donald Trump talking up his position in them, or polls in Iowa that were off base, or even people saying that we, the media, pay too much attention to polls. But polling is a crucial business. It drives debates, fundraising, and strategy. And the business model is changing rapidly. To tell us about it, we brought in Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I want to talk about the polling business and how it's changed. We've seen Gallup, you know, the sort of emblematic polling institution for a very long time, ending its horse race polling. What does this mean for the business of doing polls?
Well, there are a few things that are going on. First off, polls are expensive to take, right? Because now you have to call cell phones and there are a whole bunch of federal laws that are set up that makes it much more expensive to call cell phones. And people are simply not responding. They're not picking up their phone when people are calling them because of caller ID.
Right, if I see a number I don't know, I'm like, sure, absolutely not.
Right, exactly. I mean, if I see a number I don't know, I'm almost certainly not going to pick up the phone. So this type of thing with response rates lower jacks up the prices of polling. It doesn't necessarily make them any less accurate. In fact, surveys show that just because response rates are down doesn't mean election polling is any less accurate, but it does jack up the price. And
so
that's
just
driving
harder
people out of the game.
It's harder to do, I guess. It's a harder business to make what, profitable?
Exactly. I mean, you know, it's much more difficult to make profitable. And most of these public surveys, unless you're lined up with a media organization, and let's be honest, media organizations, especially newspapers, don't have a lot of money these days. There's not a lot of profit to be had in this business.
How are polling companies doing things differently now to account for the fact that some people only have a cell phone or that people avoid calls they don't know? How do they change their businesses?
Well, there are a few ways. Number one, they can try and call cell phones. That's very, very expensive. I think that's the proper way to do it if I were, you know, listing the best bet. But some companies, in fact, are going to internet samples. And there are multiple ways of conducting surveys via the internet, the most common of which is you get some sort of online panel and you then try and weight that panel to what the general population looks like. And those can be pretty good in general elections, right? But in primaries, it can be a much more tricky business. And some pollsters are doing different things than other pollsters. And there really haven't been too many primary polls in the past to really get a good idea of how accurate these online polls will actually be.
How does this change the kind of people to whom pollsters have access? If you're talking about things that have moved online, not everybody has internet access. Does that mean you're not surveying some lower income voters or you're missing older people who are very reliable voters?
Sure. There are two things. Some internet pollsters, in fact, try and figure out a way to get these people who are not necessarily online to take their surveys. Many do not. If they don't, you're basically trying to hope that the people who are taking these online surveys don't differ politically from those who, you know, do. And you can therefore weight up the number of old people in the survey, and you can weight down perhaps the people who are less likely to vote. But in the United Kingdom, for instance, it didn't necessarily work out that well. In fact, what you saw was there were not enough older people in the survey, and there were too many younger people in the survey, and it ended up that they very much underestimated how well the Conservatives were going to do in that general election.
I want you to walk through the consequences of some of this for me, because I think if you're listening to this, you could think like, well, who cares? So like a poll's not entirely accurate, but there are real world consequences here. Who's on the stage to debate, all of that kind of stuff. What happens if polling isn't as robust as it once was?
Well, I think you hit on one of them. I mean, this year, the Republican side has been using polling to determine who would get on stage and who didn't. And Carly Fiorina was all upset because the polling didn't exactly line up, and then she dropped out after New Hampshire. So that's one real-world consequence. But I'd offer one that I think is much more damaging, and that is in primaries, when you have all these candidates running, there's a lot of strategic voting that's happening. And I think there are voters, smart voters, who are looking at these polls and trying to get an idea of who they want to vote for of these three candidates, who has the best chance of winning. Because let's say you're a person who wants to stop Donald Trump. Do I vote for Rubio? Do I vote for Kasich? Do I vote for Bush? Because I want to stop him. And if the polls aren't accurate, then your strategic voting might in fact be off.
Look forward in an election cycle for me. Can we have a sense of what this is going to be like next time?
I think that you're going to see fewer and fewer people calling people by phone. I think you're going to get a lot more internet polling. We have a lot more internet polling this time around.
Is it accurate?
It can be. I mean, internet polling can be very accurate. I mean, I think SurveyMonkey, for instance, and I should tell everyone I know people there, but SurveyMonkey was very accurate in 2014 in the Senate elections. They were very accurate in the United Kingdom elections. So I think there is hope for the future. It's just going to take some time to figure out exactly how to do it.
Harry Anton from 538, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Since it's Valentine's Day weekend, there is chocolate pretty much everywhere. And there's a good chance that the cocoa beans that made that chocolate came from the Ivory Coast. It's the top cocoa exporter in the world, but the country wants to start keeping more of that cocoa at home and grinding it there. Right now, only about a third of the cocoa is processed locally, and it's kind of a two-pronged strategy, making the most of natural resources and adding jobs. The BBC's Tamison Ford has the story.
Vivian Quadio uses a long pole to knock cocoa pods out of the trees. The 45-year-old farmer has 5 hectares of cocoa. It's tough, physical work. Everything is done by hand. To make it worse, the nearest factory is more than 4 hours' drive away.
It's serious because there isn't a factory and the transport and all that is expensive. But if there was a factory here in Abenguru, we could go there ourselves to sell our cocoa. That would be much better.
In fact, there used to be a factory here. Vivian's uncle worked there before he died. It was his salary that sent her to school. He lost his job when the factory shut down.
Yes, it changed our lives because we could sell our produce directly to the factory.
In Abidjan, the economic capital, skyscrapers litter the financial district. The impressive skyline was built in the 70s on cocoa, not chocolate. Ivory Coast simply shipped the raw beans to Europe, where most of the processing took place. Economist Kadi Farika Koulibaly.
32% of our GDP revenues are coming from agriculture, and it's mostly from exporting and shipping raw materials as they are. And we are not keeping for the population the bulk of the added value that could be taken from agriculture. So obviously we need to transform and keep some of it here, being able to have more employment for the people who are working now on the plantation. They can also be working in the factories.
But things are changing. Last year, the country's only chocolate factory opened, producing chocolate spreads and cocoa powder. It's expected to produce Ivorian chocolate too for local consumption. This year, Ivory Coast is set to overtake the Netherlands as the leading bean-grinding hub. And President Alassane Ouattara says he wants half of the country's yearly crop of nearly 2 million tonnes of cocoa to be processed here by 2020. That's up from only 30% now.
It's realistic, but we need to increase the financing that the government is giving to that industry, and not only wait until we have foreign direct investment to actually match what is needed from Côte d'Ivoire. Côte d'Ivoire needs to lead the way and call upon the others to help, but need to finance its share at a higher level.
Ivorian chocolate is a rarity in Ivory Coast. You can find it. You just need to look a little harder. The day's batch of truffles are being made at La Maison du Chocolat, the first Ivorian chocolate shop in the country. Kante Adema, the chief chocolate maker here, is just filling trays and trays of chocolate. It's quite a complicated process. Everything is done by hand in this chocolate shop. Rita, one of the shop assistants, is taking each chocolate and wrapping them individually in pieces of gold and silver foil. Pierrette Monet, the manager, takes me on a tour of the shop. In front of me is a huge basket of shards of chocolate. It's not actually chocolate. It's the chocolate mass they buy straight from the factory. And if you taste it, it's incredibly bitter. Imagine the darkest chocolate you could buy from the supermarket, times that by 10, and that's the sort of taste that you get. No sugar, nothing else inside. It's just the pure chocolate. The chocolates aren't cheap, around $7 per 100 grams, but their clientele is the country's growing middle and upper classes. Au lait, s'il vous plaît. I'm just about to taste some of this chocolate. Salut!
Merci!
It's very good.
I'm proud to work in this shop because it's the first chocolaterie in Côte d'Ivoire and Abidjan where the chocolate is made locally and artisanally.
Pierrette hopes the government plans to increase the local processing of cocoa might encourage more chocolate makers too.
There are lots of people who are passionate about chocolate here who would like to open a chocolate shop like ours, so maybe we'll have competitors in the years to come.
Ah.
Back in Abanguru, cocoa farmer Vivian is busy preparing food for her three children and the other families on the plantation. President Ouattara's vision for the cocoa sector would not only bring more money into the country, it would directly affect families like Vivian's.
If the factory returns, there are so many young people who could work there and who would benefit from the work and be able to send their children to school too.
Ivory Coast may be built on cocoa, but it's hoped the future will be built on chocolate too. Tamasin Ford, BBC News, Abanguru, Ivory Coast.
That's Tamasin Ford. That story came to us from our partners at the BBC. No matter who you are, you probably had a first job that changed you, or you learned a financial lesson that stuck with you. Each week, we ask actors, writers, comedians, and musicians to open up and tell us about how money played a role in their life. It's called the Marketplace Quiz, and here again is Marketplace producer Raghu Manavalan with this week's guest.
Hi, this is Paul Reiser, and fun fact is that in high school, I was voted the least fun factable person.
Fill in the blank. Money can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you.
Money can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you a car. And with that car, you could go out and try to get happy. It also, you can buy the names of people who can connect you to happy-making things. So it's not a bad thing. People look down upon money. No, money can't buy happiness, but lack of money can buy unhappiness. I'm going to get that printed up on a mug.
In a next life, what would your career be?
In my next life, I would like to be the guy who sits at home, comes up with an idea for an app that sells for $1 billion. Which is, I notice now I have a lot of friends whose kids, that is the extent of their career plan. They sit at home and they scratch their heads and they go, I am going to come up with it. I have an idea. There are billion dollar ideas out there. I just have to tap it. But there's no gradation. There's no let me work and work until something becomes bigger. I love that the business model is now, I'm just going to go straight to the billion-dollar idea. It'll take me a minute, though. So in my next life, I'd like to be the person sitting next to the idea. I don't need the billion. I just want to go, ooh, I was there when that happened.
What is the hardest part about your job that no one knows?
Interesting question. The hardest thing about my job that no one knows. I always quote George Carlin, who said, I perform for free, but you got to pay me to sit in the airport. I always thought that's about it. That's exactly right. It's like there's nothing more fun for a comedian. If you're born to be a comedian, there's nothing more fun than being on stage. It's all the hours getting up to it that need to be compensated.
What is something you bought that you now completely regret buying?
What have I bought that I... Let me think about this. Gee, you know, it's a little bit of a quiz. I'm going to be honest. I wanted so badly a football helmet, and I was about 11, and I didn't play football. I would just play catch in the backyard with friends, and then but I felt, and I grew up in the city, so I wanted to be that guy. So I put on a helmet, and there was no team of helmeted other guys, so I would run into a wall, and I did it once. I went, you know what? That's not that fun. And I regretted having really insisted on the helmet. It's a lovely ashtray now in my den.
When did you realize acting could be an actual career?
You know, when I first realized acting could lead to something, when I got out of trouble in school and I just fibbed my way and I said, no, that wasn't me at all. I know it looks like I broke that, but what happened? And I was so convinced, I went, you know what? This is going to work out. I actually lied myself right out of prison time.
What was your first job?
My first job, I had a job in college working in a warehouse, and I had to come in early in the morning, and I had to drive a little golf cart around the yard and just take inventory of what trucks, what trailers were dropped off during the night and just write them down. I would invariably miss about six of them, and I would go into the head guy and he went, come here, hey, college kid, How did you miss? This is an 80-foot trailer. How did you miss it? Yeah, well, I didn't see it. It was kind of, it was dark. I don't know. But I would actually miss entire trucks. So I decided, I made a note on my career option list, trucking industry, perhaps not for me.
What advice do you wish someone gave you before you started your career?
The only piece of advice that I ever got growing up, and it's the same advice that I offer everybody now, from my children to strangers, take a jacket. Take a jacket because you never, you know, you can always not wear it. But you, if you don't have it, you can't wear it. So I said, take a jacket, either for warmth or for formality or just to have pockets to put stuff in. You can't go wrong with a light jacket.
You can see Paul Reiser in his latest film, War on Everyone. If you were getting nostalgic for Mad About You, listening to Paul Reiser just now, you're going to love a whole slew of shows that TV executives are bringing forward, or bad pun, bringing back, whatever. Full House, or rather Fuller House, a MacGyver reboot, and my personal favorite, Twin Peaks. Here to talk about the business of nostalgia is Marketplace's entertainment correspondent, Adrian Hill. Hi, Adrian.
Hey, Lizzie.
Can you give me a picture of what is happening and why all of these old shows are coming back?
There are so many, it's hard to know where to begin. As you mentioned, Full House is coming back on Netflix as Fuller House. And just to whet your appetite, Lizzie, here's a little cut from the trailer.
Isn't this crazy? I wound up living back in my old bedroom. I moved in here when I was 5. Now here we are again. It's a circle of life. Oh, look, and there's Simba.
Hola, Tannerinos!
That might be enough for you to get a sense of...
Circle of Life, back to our old TV shows.
Back to our roots. So there also is going to be a reboot of The Gilmore Girls, MacGyver, like you mentioned.
That.
I know. Prison Break is coming back for another season. A Twin Peaks reboot, again, like you mentioned, coming back on the air, which is exciting.
Yes.
X-Files has just premiered, so it's a huge, huge list of shows.
It is a huge... What is happening here?
Well, for one, it's just a safe business plan. I mean, right now, the television landscape is so crowded that everyone's looking for a way to stand out, for a way to actually get people to watch their shows. And for a lot of these shows, there's a built-in fan base. There are people who grew up with these shows, who love these shows, who want to see what's going on. I mean, who doesn't want to know how life has treated Rory and Lorelai? You know, or which of their boyfriends she might get back with?
I actually just spent some time on the internet looking at, you know... Which of Rory's boyfriends is your favorite?
Which is your favorite?
Jess.
Right?
The others were kind of sad sacks.
Well, he's
like,
a
Jess
sad
had some
sack
issues,
too,
but like all of her boyfriends were actually, like, none of them held a candle to her. But anyway, such is life. So this is sort of across the spectrum of TV creators. That's one of the things that I find interesting. It's not just Netflix. It's the broadcast nets, too. It's everybody.
Yeah, I mean, and everyone sort of has a different reason to do it. For Netflix, it's about getting people subscribing or keeping people subscribing. The broadcast networks have a different challenge, and they need to create programming that keeps them relevant in this hyper-competitive landscape that's going to attract a lot of eyeballs that also will get ad dollars. I think there's something interesting, too, for us viewers. And these shows can seem like maybe a safer option. I don't know, Lizzie, if this has happened to you, but I feel like I start so many new shows that I just am so frustrated with at the end.
You, like, just kind of lose it after 3 episodes?
I lose it, and then no one else is even watching it, so I can't even complain about it with anyone else. At least with these reboots, I know that if the new Gilmore Girls is terrible, I can come in and be like, oh, it's terrible. And so I haven't wasted all my time, right? I can complain with other people.
Well, that which is very important. I am interested that this isn't just about the sort of cult favorites with the built-in audience. I mean, I am a Twin Peaks stan forever, but this is other stuff.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these are interesting choices. We saw Netflix rebooted the movie Wet Hot American Summer as a television show, which I thought was fantastic.
Yeah,
and
I'm with you there.
That movie initially... you know, didn't do great. It became sort of a cult favorite over time and over years. And then they brought back this television show, which was really a sort of lovely updating. There's TV in the works based on the film Training Day, another show based on Cruel Intentions. And one of the shows I'm hopeful for is a Nancy Drew reboot. It got a pilot order from CBS. Nancy Drew is now 30. She's in the modern world. She might be a diverse Nancy Drew, which would be great. So we'll see. I mean... that's kind of exciting, right? What's Nancy Drew up to?
Some of these shows have their original casts, Gilmore,
fuller house, but you know, sometimes that is not possible. The log lady from Twin Peaks.
Rest in peace.
The actress, right, exactly. So how much does it matter if the actors are back? Some of the actors who were in, you know, TV shows a long time ago have gone on to be really expensive megastars.
I think it's a good question. Part of the appeal of having this original cast back is seeing how people have aged, right? I mean, maybe that's a really bad thing to admit, but we want to know, what do 14 years look like or 10 years like on these characters? But that's an appeal with a short lifespan. I think the trick with actually succeeding at these reboots is coming up with a storyline that people want to watch.
So that brings us back to the nostalgia question that we started with. What if it's not as good as you remember?
Well, I mean, that's going to happen, right? You know, I think about things I watched when I was a kid, and whether they're movies or television shows. And if I rewatch them now, they're just, I'm like, that's what I liked. There is a risk with all of these that fans will be disappointed. And this happened in some ways with the X-Files reboot. You build up the show in your mind for years and years and years. Then the new show is out and it underwhelmed a lot of people. I read an interesting review in The Guardian of the X-Files that pointed out how much sort of TV and the world has changed since the original was on. And things that were resonant then, that really like pushed our buttons, aren't that resonant now. And I think that's the risk, is like, what is there about this show that is still relevant today? And will it have that emotional relevance, especially to really like tap in?
Which is exactly, I guess, what these companies are hoping for, right?
Yeah.
I think I know the answer to this. But what are you the most excited about?
I wish that I was a sophisticate and could say Twin Peaks, but I'm going to go with Gilmore Girls because, man, Rory and Lorelai, what are they doing? How has life treated them? I need to know.
We're going to find out. Marketplace's Adrian Hill, who covers entertainment for us. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
So, I think we should confess something here on the air.
Oh, my God.
You and I, we're work spouses.
Yeah.
Oh, that was damning.
Yeah.
No, we're work spouses.
Yeah.
We share, we talk.
Yeah.
We have, you know,
We fight.
Yeah. We have a relationship, platonic work spouse relationship. And like any relationship, the key to that is good communication. Like it's, me banging on the wall when you're too loud or things like that.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. I mean, it's our crosses to bear.
But since this is our special Valentine's Day edition of Tech in Real Life,
yes,
I would like you to talk about how tech figures into relationships, because this is just a minefield.
I have the conch shell. Is that what you're telling me?
Yes, you do. Go ahead.
So we could talk about the text fade, right? We
ghosting.
Could talk about the many, many, many reasons not to send naked photos of yourself on any messaging platform to anyone.
Ever.
Right? Ever. But actually, let's talk about that for a second, actually.
Oh, God.
Alexandra Solomon, professor at Northwestern University, she teaches about relationships, and I think she's got actually a really good rule of thumb here that applies to a lot of how we think about tech and love.
It comes back, for me, again and again, to talking to people about discernment and being conscious about how and when and where you choose to integrate technology and love, and that when it happens mindlessly and just kind of carelessly, I think that's when couples get themselves into trouble.
So I think this is a really good guiding principle.
Yeah.
Don't be mindless. Yeah, don't be mindless. We have these devices that have become both the conduit for finding new relationships and the conduit for managing those relationships. And there are pitfalls that come with all of that, because whether it's sending photos or some form of messaging,
or ignoring your partner for your smartphone.
Exactly. I think having conversations not in person does actually make it easier to make those conversations less personal and those interactions less personal. And that's a pitfall.
And yet, at the same time, there are the sort of the development of these apps that are all about relationships. This floored me.
Yeah.
Can you please run me through this?
So many apps. And, of course, there's Tinder and et cetera, et cetera.
Right. But we're not talking dating apps. We're talking about relationship apps.
Yeah. So let me throw out some examples. Okay. Couple. This is an app that lets you and your partner share messages, videos, allows you to draw together, which is, you know, it's built a little bit for long distance relationships, okay. We can say. Avocado does a lot of similar things in a way. Keep all your shared pictures, videos, and messages in one place. You can even hug your loved one by holding your phone to your chest. It does this like hugging thing.
Okay.
That's nice.
Mm-hmm. So these are all sort of like, you're a couple, everything's lovely. Yeah. Let's turn to the darker side,
dun, dun,
please.
Dun.
What happens when you break up? Because, man, if you've got like pictures and video.
It gets really bad, right?
Yeah.
It gets really bad, as we all know. And true story, there are, in all seriousness, apps that help you with breakups. So there's Cloak. This is an anti-social media app that lets users sort of protect their location data, helps you avoid friends, coworkers, and ex-partners.
Oh.
So interesting.
Okay.
We'll just put that out there.
Sure.
There's also RX Breakup. This is an app that is also apparently going to be turned into a social network to help you get over it. It helps you get over recent breakups or lingering obsessions.
How so?
It has this 30-day guide that delivers professionally developed self-help techniques in the tone of a trusted girlfriend.
So it's just like,
or
don't
buddy.
Call him. Don't call him.
Yeah,
don't click on that picture.
Don't do it, man. Don't do it.
Sure.
And then, of course, you may have heard about this. Facebook has added features to its platform that help you navigate the ending of a relationship digitally.
How does that manifest?
You can do a few different things. You can actually start to exclude photos and things from the feed of your ex in your news feed so that you don't have to see those painful updates. There are also relationship counseling apps.
This fascinates me. Counseling, isn't it about the face-to-face? How does this work in an app?
So this is actually a really tricky area, Lizzie, because when you have a therapist or something, a lot of this information that you're trading with your therapist is confidential, right?
Sure.
And doing that on a phone gets really tricky. But there are apps that dabble in this area. There's Couple Counseling and Chatting. It's a free app. It's built by a real therapist. It's supposed to help couples figure out why they are fighting when they are in a fight. Which is kind of interesting, right? By you know, sending them queries and things like that.
Presumably, if it's not because they're on their phone.
Yeah. This kind of thing is based on real data about how people in relationships communicate these days. There was a recent study from Pew that found a quarter of people in relationships actually use devices to communicate while they're both at home together.
Wow.
That is super strange to me, which again is something Alexandra Solomon is thinking about, this kind of interaction.
It seems like the findings are that we are not the same online as we are in person. There are parts of us that become amplified online and parts of us that get quieter online. So our screen persona and our face-to-face persona are not quite the same thing.
So I think that's key, Lizzie. We have to remember how tech and our relationships are intertwined even more and more these days, and that we have more tools. But like any technology, we should tread really carefully with how we use those tools with our loved ones.
Well, then I'll say it to you face to face. Happy Valentine's Day, Ben.
Happy Valentine's, Lizzie.
And that's our show for this week. Next week, we're going to hear about your most memorable impulse buys. Come share your story. Visit marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, or call 1-800-648-5114. Your voice might be featured on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan, Haley Hirschman, with help this week from Shayna Deloria. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Jeff Peters is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.